Are you satisfied with your understanding of sustainability? If you are not, imagine a journey together, a pluralistic one, with academia, innovators, startups, NGOs, all looking for solutions to the greatest challenge of our time. My name is Samuele Tini, and this is the Sustainability Journey. Welcome to another episode. Today, we are going to discuss sustainable finance, and we are going to put two words together, green and Wall Street, which usually, they don't go well together. And we do it with somebody at the forefront of sustainability, who is a published and a New York Times bestseller author and the founder of Wall Street Green Summit. So I want to welcome Peter Fusaro. Thank you so much, Peter, for being here with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
And sustainable finance, Wall Street Green Summit, sustainability. I'm so excited of this episode. But our first question is always, who is Peter? Can you share your journey and how you have become a sustainability expert?
Yes, it really goes back to my childhood and playing in the woods in New York, and went to the first Earth Day in 1970 with my solar power t-shirt at Carnegie Mellon University. So I've been very dedicated to this area of sustainability before it had names. So I was eating organic food from food co-ops in the early 70s, things like that. So I actually practice what I preach. And then the career path, people don't remember, but in the 1970s, we had two energy shocks, oil shocks. And so I went to work at the Federal Energy Administration, which became the Department of Energy. And one of my first tasks was to get the lead out of gasoline with the Environmental Protection Agency. So my entire career has really focused on energy and environment. Energy is 73% of greenhouse gases. Energy is the world's largest business, $6 trillion. And energy needs to make what I'm calling the transformation, not the transmission, the transformation to sustainability. So that career path, I was public policy maker in Washington, D.C. in the 70s. I'm a native New Yorker. I worked for the mayor's office, created the first energy efficiency programs in New York City in the 80s with the two utilities. And then I decided I didn't want to work in the public sector and made a pivot to the private sector, worked at a startup that transmitted energy information by email and fax in 1989, very early. Computers were very late. I've worked in four startups. Long story short, getting all these accolades now, I've had my own single shingle consultancy, Global Change Associates, for 33 years, and very proud of that. I've worked with major corporations. So everything I do is about energy and environment. The last 25 years, I've been a professor at Columbia University teaching renewable energy project finance. That's now two classes because I decided policy students should also learn about finance. So I taught a class on financial modeling. I've run a venture capital fund in clean technology. I've worked in the hedge fund world in portfolio construction. So I'm kind of self-taught all this finance. And long story short, we need more education in this sector. Last 3 years, I've worked with Oxford University and Stanford University on sustainability. They have just created sustainability colleges. So I can also make a point that academia is a little slow, a little behind the curve. The students really want this information. My class at Columbia was oversubscribed. They had to use algorithms to choose the students. It was only 25 students once a year. So I think we are in the beginning of major business transformation. And I have spent a lot of time the last 25 years helping young people get their careers going. One's now a co-manager at the World Bank Disruptive Technology Fund. One, it works for a private equity fund in New York. So I'm very happy to see the people that I've mentored have actually been very successful, maybe even more successful than their mentor. But that's good. But what I see, because I'm also an expert in carbon markets, we've seen fit in that. So what's really occurred now in the 2020s is the beginning of two new markets. Environmental social governance, ESG investing, despite all the negativity of the press, it's still growing. And secondly, the carbon market. Now, the carbon market is quite important for a couple of reasons. There's a compliance market for utilities and industrial companies in Europe, US, Canada. But the other market is the voluntary market. Major corporations are going to be unable to be carbon neutral by 2030. They just can't innovate fast enough. So they're going to have to buy carbon credits. What are those carbon credits? They can be nature-based solutions. They can be forestry credits. They can be biodiversity credits. In the U.S., we have something called the renewable energy credit market, where major corporations buy renewable energy, not because it's mandated, because they can't attract young employees to work for them. It's not just a business decision. It's also important that they have to be sustainable. And that means we're in the beginning of this journey. And the good news is, after 54 years working in sustainability and not having the name green, sustainability, ESG, we are in the beginning of the biggest sea change I've ever seen globally in the world. So, for example, solar energy, which 20 years ago was very, very expensive, cheap now. What does that mean? It means it could be deployed everywhere in the world, and it is being deployed in the world. We call that bending the cost curve. And by that, you can have global deployment. Similarly, in many developing countries, there's a need for electricity, not just in cities, but in villages. So there's such things as microgrids, which I've been involved with. Microgrids are small scale that can create energy, electricity, in villages, for e-education, for lighting, so people can, you know, in some places in the world, people don't think about this, but 1.3 billion people live in the dark. They live in huts with kerosene wicker lamps. And I worked in India with an NGO where we took a solar collector, a battery, and an LED lamp and helped 25,000 families to have 5 hours of lighting in the evening. It's very important to me that we lift all the boats, and we do this everywhere in the world. And we can do this. We have the money, we have the technology, we have the smarts, we just need the vision.
Thank you, Peter, for this wonderful intro. You have just laid a full plate of topics that we want to go deeper. And I think this transformation and this, it is getting now towards your summit, the 2024 Wall Street Green Summit, that is your creature. So can you explain to our audience that are not familiar why it's so significant, and what are you trying to achieve with the summit?
Well, I started the Wall Street Green Summit 23 years ago, and people thought I was a little crazy. Why would Wall Street be green? So I kind of stuck out like a U.S. expression, sore thumb. However, over the 23 years, 9,000 people have attended the summit. And the purpose of the summit is twofold. One is business development, to have people work together on projects, on finance, on deployment of new ideas and technology. But the second thing is building community. So as I mentioned, when having 9,000 people come to an event over 23 years, you actually create community. And so this year, the summit will only be 175 people. It's not going to be huge. I don't like really big, you know, trade shows with 2,000 people. I just got invited to something in Paris with 30,000 people. I'm not interested in 30,000 people. I don't think you can talk to 30,000 people. So it's important to really to meet and greet. And I'm very dedicated also to young people and also the press. We have press there. There will be a major announcement at the summit, which I can't tell anybody about yet, but the second largest private equity fund in the world is going to make an announcement about the energy transition. So we have a lot of movement of capital going towards sustainability. $100 trillion in the next 30 years for the globe to decarbonize. What does that mean? It means taking the carbon out of things you don't think about, like steel manufacturing, like transportation. I'm a big advocate for hydrogen. So we're seeing hydrogen trains, hydrogen ships. Hydrogen is the most plentiful element in the universe. The problem there is we need to reduce the cost of capital for hydrogen and deploy it globally. It's very similar to what I mentioned about solar power. Solar was very, very, and then became very cheap and plentiful. The game is get the costs down. So that's really what sustainable finance is about. It's sustainable finance in energy, in agriculture, in water. Unfortunately, the OECD, the developed world, wastes too much. It's extremely wealthy. And really, there's a movement now, I think, that's starting to occur. The more people are looking at the global south. How can we work with the global south? So I just want to mention two projects that I'm working on. One is agroforestry in Peru, where the gentleman from Canada is paying the farmers to plant crops and trees, and Amazon.com is buying the carbon credits. So that's kind of an interesting conundrum because carbon, as I mentioned, is very important. Secondly, as everyone knows, the oceans are warming. So fishing in the northern climates like Norway, New Zealand, or Alaska are going down. The catch is going down. So there is now a new school of thought, and I'm working on this, to grow fish in warm water. So offshore Panama, we are growing kampachi. About 8 miles offshore, this fish move in a circle. They're very lean and muscular and taste pretty good. I had some sushi. It was very good. The second site will be Bali. The need in the world, this goes under the SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals, is the need for protein. People are going to move away from red meat and move toward oceans and grains and things that are that have nourishment. So I'm pretty excited about two things. They're small. These are not big projects, but you have to start small. Where I sit as an investment banker is that we want to grow these companies to be commercialized, to get bigger. And then you can globally deploy. So it's all starting for small things. I'll give you an example. When I worked on the Prius, Toyota Prius, 1997-98, it took 10 years to sell a million cars. 10 years. So I think any transformation starts with an outlier and then becomes mainstream. As I mentioned before, organic food, which I was eating in the early 1970s and people thought I was nuts, now it's very mainstream all over the world. So my point is, things take time. Piece of this, I've worked with the World Economic Forum on impact investing. You have to have patient capital. You have to have people that don't want a quick fix, that really want to make the world a better place. And unfortunately, it doesn't happen quickly. It takes time to build, scale, perfect. I've been very involved with technology companies as part of Columbia Tech Ventures, early stage companies. A lot of them are going to fail. It's just unfortunate. They're not all going to succeed. But some of those early stage companies are going to be very successful and make a lot of money. Two areas of my focus are hydrogen and batteries. Hydrogen for both transportation for fuel cell vehicles and energy storage to make electricity. But the second piece of this is energy storage, battery technology. We're going to see batteries, big batteries and little batteries made with different materials, not just lithium ion, which is very heat intensive, but things like zinc air batteries or airflow batteries. There's a lot of science here, what we call material science. I went to Carnegie Mellon University and they had a whole department in material science. I'm not an engineer, but in my career, I've had to learn how things work. And so watch battery storage. We're starting to look at this in the developed world of bigger batteries are being deployed near large power generating stations to stabilize the grid. The grid here where I live in New York is 120 years old. It's very old. We'll probably see more deployment of microgrids, which will leapfrog technology for villagers. And that's not a small number. The number I've seen, and no one's doubting it anymore, is 1.3 billion people have no access to electricity in the world. And that's just a very sad state of affairs.
Peter, I mean, I'm excited, and I can see now from the early pioneers like you, now there is a whole movement towards sustainability. And I'm glad also what you have mentioned for the summit, the announcement that will be made. So big names are jumping on board the sustainability. However, let me ask you a question. You have also written a book, a bestseller, New York Times bestseller. It was about what went wrong at Enron and all the problems that we have there. And some critics say, hey, we don't want sustainability to become just a bandwagon where everybody is jumping on board without changing. So a convenient purpose, as one book I read recently was discussing. So how we can avoid the same issues with the system that happened, you know, in the crisis at the early 20 years ago, with sustainability, so from the greenwashing to even fraud. So what is your point on that?
Well, unfortunately, when I was also wrote the book on Enron, I was also in the first case on Enron. So I was in the belly of the beast, and the bad actors were the banks. The banks lent Enron money. It wasn't like, no, we didn't give Enron money. They gave Enron money. So we do have an issue with the banks. I'm not going to denigrate the banks since my summit's about banking and finance, but there will be bad actors. What I was really hoping would happen in the US was the Securities and Exchange Commission would issue its final rule on ESG, environmental social governance. That has not happened yet. Now, why is that important? Twofold. One, major corporations would have to disclose their environmental footprint. They'd also have to go down into the supply chain, which is called scope 3. That's quite important. So if you start looking at the global supply chain for sustainability, it affects everything that's going on. So for example, Apple Computer, which sources material from Taiwan, is asking Taiwanese companies to measure their carbon footprint. So what I'm getting at is that would have been helpful. So once again, companies are doing this volitionally. They're not being mandated to do it. I think there'll always be laggards, and the laggards may not do very well and might not survive. This is a very rapidly changing world that people don't understand. Technology is quite important. And I know there's a lot of emphasis now on AI. So I kind of focus on AI and sustainability. So how can we do self-driving cars? How can we do big data sets and quantum computing to make predictive models? So my lens is very narrow. It's energy, food, and water. And how do we make these big industries more sustainable? So energy is a $6 trillion business. Food is a $5 trillion business. Water is a $3 trillion business. These are major global multinational businesses that have to change.
And I think you are at the forefront of change due to your work with startups and disruptor in this field that want to challenge the incumbent with the technology that you have mentioned, new batteries, new way of doing the sustainable fishing and other projects. So in your position at the Columbia Tech as professor, you say you mentor startup companies. How you can work? I mean, you have mentioned some example. How you are working with those startups to build sustainability from the onset and go beyond just like return on profit, but also, you know, return on purpose and the planet?
Well, it goes to who are the investors? And there are really four classes of investors. There are pension funds. So there's tremendous wealth in pension funds in the US and Europe, particularly in Japan. There are strategic investors. Those are energy companies or agricultural conglomerates. There are sovereign wealth funds, such as Temasek in Singapore or the Saudis. What I'm starting to see in sovereigns, they're starting to go down and invest in little companies. And finally, their family offices, which are high net worth individuals, are first movers in sustainable finance and have patient capital since they're investing for the long term. So that's where impact investing got started. But really what's occurring, it's a little different. So what I've noticed is the very big companies have what I call technology scouts. They go out and look for the new companies. The large companies are not entrepreneurial. They are not innovative. They cannot create the future. What they can do is buy those companies, which they do do. So that's really the business model here is a little different, where everybody thinks, I'm going to make all this money on an IPO, initial public offering. That's not going to happen so much. What's actually going to happen is large corporations are going to buy the new technology companies, be they in energy storage and batteries, be they in transportation and mobility, in solar, wind, geothermal, whatever. The large companies will buy the small companies. You can almost think about eating the fish, but that's the model. And just to give you some landscape, in the United States, there are half as many public companies today than there were 25 years ago. They're just not there anymore. So if you want to watch the stock exchanges for sustainability, that's really not the right parameter. I work in the world of private companies that are not well understood, not well tracked, and that's where the innovation's coming from. I went back to Carnegie Mellon, my alma mater, and on all the mobility of the self-driving cars, Uber took the entire part of Carnegie Mellon, including the professors and students, out of Carnegie Mellon. So the genesis of self-driving actually came from Carnegie Mellon, which is the number one school in robotics in the planet. So the point is, universities have deep benches of technology. They have professors that mentor students. They start companies in universities. Columbia University, which is a mile from me, I'm in Manhattan in the Upper West Side, has a new business and $500 million new campus. Why? To have workbenches where people can actually create technology companies. New York City, which is not really understood as a technology center, is number two now in the country in venture capital. New York City is a climate tech center. New York City has 600,000 students. Google considers New York City one of its six global ecosystems. We have a new university on Cornell Technology. So we have a lot of technology centers now in New York City that you wouldn't think about. Now, why is that important? Because you have the ecosystem, you have the financial ecosystem, and now you have the technology ecosystem, and you also have media, so you can broadcast what's going on. So I don't know if folks are aware, but we do have Climate Week. Now, why do we have Climate Week? 4.5 years ago, Columbia University School of Journalism decided, let's get together with 30 news organizations and message Climate Week. Because of that event for 1 week, the entire planet now gets climate information on the news all the time. It didn't happen by accident. It happened by a concerted effort, ironically, from a meteorologist told me about this at Columbia University. So what I'm getting at, some of this is educational, some of this is technology, some of this is finance, and some of this is public policy. Here in the U.S., we've had three major bills, I'll call them climate bills, under the Biden administration. There's the Inflation Reduction Act, about $400 billion, the Transportation Bond Act, and the CHIPS Act. So the Biden people have kind of jump-started a lot of new initiatives, particularly in areas like green hydrogen and energy storage. They have put a lot of dollars, over $400 billion, to be deployed from now until 2030. But this is the tip of the iceberg. That's not enough money. The private sector is going to pick up the slack. Those banks I talked about are going to pick up the slack. There's a very interesting play going on now for what's called intellectual property, IP. Insurance funds will lend money against intellectual property in sustainability. So there's a lot of change occurring in the financial institutions.
Fantastic. And I really want to, you have touched this during your introduction on this part, and it's really important to touch on two parts of your expertise. One is the first one, it is decarbonization, energy transition, and transformation of our energy. You have touched, you have said hydrogen, you have said the grids and everything. So you are advising company and you're advising big names and financing also, supporting them. So how do you work with them? Which are the goals for them in decarbonization, energy transition? How do you see our path from this 2024 to 2030, when we are supposed to reach at least the neutrality?
The good news is I'm not an employee of any of these companies. So there's always career risk for sticking out. I've worked for a big government. I've worked for a big oil company. I work for a big Swedish-Swiss conglomerate, ABB. So I've worked with big corporations. My clients are big. But the issue is, how do you make these changes? And the changes are manifest. So the first thing to do is to measure your carbon footprint. You would be surprised. Software companies such as Persephone, Watershed, Patch, Silvera have all been funded north of $100 million, which I've never seen before, to do one thing: measure the carbon footprint of corporations and measure the carbon footprint of private equity portfolio companies. So a lot of private equity funds, we have 4,000 in New York, own a lot of deep carbon companies that need to be decarbonized. What does that mean? It means you've got to look at business practices and emissions. You have to start looking at electric vehicles, which are getting a tremendous jolt around the world. I'm just reading the Chinese are going to be a major exporter of EVs. I'm very big on hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. You have to look at buildings. Here in New York City, where I live, we have 950,000 buildings. They are not green. Only new construction is what we call LEED Platinum green. So there's tremendous opportunity in what we call the building retrofit market. What does that mean? It means the lighting. It means the heating and cooling systems. It means their boilers. It even means the windows. I've worked with technology companies that can create solar energy a window. We have a handful of hotels and school that are doing that in the New York metropolitan area, but it's called building integrated photovoltaic. Makes a lot of sense because you're not going to see solar collectors on top of 950,000 vertical buildings in New York City. So large cities, which really are vertical and densely populated, have different choices to make than solar farms. They can, you know, wheel power in from solar farms, but they really need to rethink how the building is used. Now, new construction is very different. Anything new is going to be sustainable and green, and people are going to look at cost reductions. But it's really the other market, which we call the retrofit market, which is actually bigger. And in developed countries, that's a very big offering to use technology like AI to, you know, turn off lights when you go into the bathroom or the building. People leave their computers on, things you wouldn't think about. When you go into urban centers, you see all these lights on, they shouldn't be on. So the point is, there are simple technologies called energy management systems that can do that. As I mentioned before, I just want to reiterate, energy is 73% of greenhouse gases. I know people get all excited about cows creating pollution, but it's really energy. And energy is only two things. Energy is transportation, cars, trucks, airlines, shipping, or buildings. That's really where energy is consumed. And so those are ripe opportunities for creating better technology, reducing the cost of capital, having a greater return on investment. And that's starting to occur. But, you know, I said it before, change is incremental. Change is slow. We do not have a lot of time, though, when it comes to the planet. I've worked with the American Meteorological Society, Harvard Medical College. Some of the epidemiological studies would scare people about infectious disease and climate change being correlated. Nobody wants to think about that. They only want to think COVID was a one-off. No, it's not, fortunately. And so we are not prepared for the forest fires that we see, for the sea catch that's going down, for the need to reforest, repopulate, really change how we do things. Even in the United States, agriculture has really used up the topsoil. So we need to regenerate a lot of the land to grow food. And we use a lot of chemicals, unfortunately. So there's actually manifest ways. It's called now regenerative agriculture. It's become a global phenomena, but it's all over the world. So I've been to 50 countries. So I've really been what's called north, south. I've been north. So I've been, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, India, all over Western Europe and US and Canada. And so we really have opportunities, in my opinion, for the global south to start rising. I'm starting to see fund managers focus on the global south for regenerative agriculture, for moving new kinds of technology. One company that I've worked with, pro bono, I don't charge for everything, by the way, it's called SkyMax. They want to bring cell towers into Kenya. What would that do? That would reduce the cost of telecommunications in Kenya so people could have access at a much lower cost. If you're looking at landlines, it's very expensive. So they're getting close. I'm 4 years in with them, and I've introduced them to investors and folks. And I hope that they succeed, because that would reduce the cost of cellular communication, which everybody uses. So for example, WhatsApp is really free telephones. It doesn't cost you anything, and you have a global telephone. So I've been thinking about that. So there's lots of opportunities, both in the developed world and the developing world. It's not one size fits all. So for example, we could leapfrog into better technologies in the developing countries and bypass some of the damage we did in the developed world and creating, we industrialized.
Fantastic. Living on this side of the world, that is how we do. So for Kenya, and this is what you told us, is fantastic, because our bank is our phone. So in our phone, then M-Pesa and the other, so they are really transforming, unlocking values for livelihoods and people all over in the rural area. So it's really important. And I totally agree. It's something that the continent of the future, Africa, where is now we'll have millions of people, more consumption, it really need to leapfrog and work on that. And I want to ask another question, a bit controversial now. Energy, you said, is important. And you mentioned at the beginning carbon credits and carbon markets. So there's been a barrage of discussion on the press. I mean, the Guardian especially has been very critical, and also some other organizations, NGOs, of those markets. As an expert, I want to ask, how do you respond to this critic? How we can improve? Which is the value of this market, and how can really bring transformation?
This is how I look at it. I mean, I cannot believe that one article has had such resonance all over the world from The Guardian, but it has. I have trained over 1,000 people on carbon trading and finance in Tokyo, in London, in San Francisco. My own opinion is some of the credits are lousy credits. The two markets, one's called the compliance market. That's for utilities and industrials that emit pollution, and they buy what's called carbon allowances. It's structured by government. There's an auction, and it's well run. It's very well developed in California and the EU. The other market, which is causing all the controversy, is called the voluntary carbon market, VCM. Now, there are bad credits, as the Brits would say, dodgy credits, but there are new standards coming. I'll give you an example. In Peru, an agroforestry has the new standard that Vera, which is one of the voluntary registries, has created with Amazon.com called Abacus. Nobody even understands what Abacus is. It's the highest standard in the voluntary markets. And frankly, a lot of credits are going to be washed away. Now, why is that going to happen? Because corporations can't buy dodgy credits. That's their reputational risk. So they have to point to, if I buy this carbon credit, where did that carbon credit come from? How was it validated? How was it verified by third-party verifiers, et cetera? So there's a lot of ignorance on carbon accounting and carbon markets. I've mentored a young woman who actually is the first person I know, a PhD student at Johns Hopkins, took a course on carbon accounting. So there's actually a lack of knowledge. But what's happening in the voluntary markets, Vera has expedited. They've actually brought in new people. They've hired more people. I was very critical. They were too slow. And there's this something called the gold standard, which is also available. It's kind of buyer beware. Ask the right questions. I know everybody's so excited about carbon tokens. I'm not. In the commodity world, we look at what's called the underlying physical market. What is actually being tokenized? What is that? Is that a project? Is that an afforestation or a reforestation project? So some of the problems that have been manifest for the last 6 months from the Guardian article are going to be fixed. It was a good article because it shined a spotlight on a problem, which now has been expedited and I think will change. But as I mentioned, go back again, my opinion, the first stage when I'm a company, what do I do to reduce my carbon footprint? Well, I optimize my operational efficiencies. That's the first thing you do. But that's not going to get you to carbon neutrality by 2030. You're going to have to buy carbon credits. And if you're a major corporation, you want to buy the best quality credits, sort of like AAA standard. You know, you don't want something that's bad. So that's a problem. And that market is going to grow astronomically. It's quite small. We have a non-profit NGO system marketplace, which tracks the entire market. It's quite small, maybe $2 billion. Most of us believe it'll be $50 billion by 2030. And the valuation of those credits will also rise. But I have worked on CDM projects under the Kyoto Protocol, which the credits really didn't materialize. We have a problem that I think will be fixed, but carbon will become much more commoditized. And here's the interesting thing. It's the simplest commodity ever created. It's CO2 equivalent, CO2e. A metric ton of carbon is a metric ton of carbon. It's been sized as a $22 trillion market by Wood Mackenzie, a noted analytical firm in Edinburgh, Scotland. So we're talking about a huge market transformation. This is the beginning of a market. I've been through this four times. The beginning of a market is very chaotic, very sloppy. There's mistakes made, but eventually we have something called rationalization will occur. We're not there yet. We're still in the evolutionary stage of the carbon market.
Peter, I think it's such an important question and a wonderful answer. So to explain even to our audience, but not everybody is familiar with these new markets, just to understand the vision and how also the evolution will go. So, and I mean, we will talk for you for hours and hours because you are an untapped source of wonderful knowledge for us. But I want to ask our last question because you are at the top. You have been at the forefront of sustainability. You are now in the Wall Street Green Summit, the Columbia Tech, and supporting companies in their effort of decarbonization. So what advice you, and since you are a mentor, which advice to give us to people like me and other young professionals that aspire to make impact in this field of sustainable finance, sustainability, and the broader sustainability?
Well, I have to say this, not everything I've done has been successful. Okay, so there are failures. My wife has an expression which I share with everybody. Don't quit before the miracle. So this is the hardest problem that man, womankind, humankind has ever seen, called climate change. And we have to throw everything we got at it because this is going to affect how people live, how people work, how people move. It's not a simple one-trick pony. This is complex. This is difficult. Work with architects, engineers, financiers, doctors, meteorologists, you name it. I have been there deep in the weeds for almost 33 years on this. It's actually March 4th, 1990. I wrote my first article, How Global Warming Would Affect the Oil and Gas Industry. So I've been here. A lot of people thought I was out of my mind talking about renewable energy 25 years ago. Well, here's the good news. You know, we have an expression in America, I have a thick skin. You can just take it. I'm a Sicilian donkey. You just have to be very tough and not quit before the miracle. You got to keep trying. This is the biggest problem we've ever faced. It's much bigger than going to Mars, much bigger than that, because this is the blue planet. And the blue planet has to be preserved. And that means things like forestry and fishing and recreation of agriculture and soil. That means how we use energy in a cleaner, greener, more efficient manner. That means how we move around in cars and travel. That means what we eat. As I mentioned, there's a real need in the world for protein. So this is not a simple solution. And for politicians, it doesn't track electoral cycles. This is a very long-dated problem that, frankly, the world has ignored since I've been working on it since March 1990. And some other people started working on this in the 1970s. The world said, oh, it's not a problem. Oh, we don't think there's a problem. Well, there's 14,000 research papers that say it's a problem. Climate change is real material. It is going to affect the balance sheets of companies. They are scared about this. It's going to devalue assets. This is the time. This is the best of times, actually. I'm very happy to be around now, 54 years later, because now is the time to do stuff. And I have a very simple metric. I call it show and tell from second grade. You can point to success stories. You can point to things. Once you start pointing to things, like, for example, the EV revolution that's underway, people will make a choice. Do I want an internal combustion engine or do I want an EV? That's what's going to occur. There's going to be benefits to making the right choices, but this is long dated. This takes time. One thing I learned in graduate school is incremental change. And that's nothing radical is going to happen. Nothing, everybody calls it disruptive. There's nothing disruptive. The disruption is climate. That's a disruption. That's the disruption to how the weather patterns have changed. That's the disruption, how we have forest fires. That's the disruption, how the ocean currents are changing. That's the disruption. That's what I'll call the X factor. The solutions take a lot of good people working very hard. And we can do this. We put people on the moon. We can't run away to Mars. This is the time. And I work a lot with young people who are fired up. And it's not a political issue with them. It's really a moral issue. It's a cultural issue. They want to contribute back to making the world a better place. And that, to me, is exciting.
Fantastic, Peter. And I think also, I hope that the podcast will resonate even your message all across our listenership around the world. And I'm really pleased and honored to have hosted you, and it's been a great honor. Thank you so much, Peter. And it's good also to host a paisano, as we said, and that I've achieved so much. Thank you so much, Peter.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure. Anytime.
Are you satisfied after this wonderful episode? Let's continue together our sustainability journey.